together and says, hey, do you want to do something? Something really good is going to come out of it. So I really want to extend my thanks to her and to everyone here at SOEX for giving us this weekend and this space. Our first group of presenters today, we have five topics, five speakers for each topic. The first topic is publishing when it's not publishing. And there are a few questions around each of these topics. For the first one, what are the economic, logistical, and technological challenges non-traditional publishing platforms face, and how do they answer the assertion that they are nailing the coffin for traditional public print publications? This is going to be a picture-to-picture presentation, which means that each speaker is going to speak for 6.5 minutes. They have 20 slides. Each slide will be on view for 20 seconds. At the two-minute mark, when they have 2 minutes left in their presentation, the lovely Devin Bella is going to raise her hands. And then at the end of the 6 minutes, a bell will be rung signaling the end of their... Yes. It's a very fresh enterprise here. When it's not publishing are Gwen Allen, Brian Andrews, and Duncan McKenzie of Bannock Sports, Ann Colvin of Skank Block Bologna, John Hershen and Will Rogan of The Thing, Tanya Kesson-Jean of The Unobserved, and I know I just mispronounced your name, I'm sorry, and it's going to be moderated by Stephen Bosch. Thank you. Speaker is Gwen Allen, who's an assistant professor of art history at San Francisco State University. Her books, Artist Magazines, and Alternative Space for Art is forthcoming from MIT Press this spring. Please turn off your cell phone.
Artist Magazines was founded by the Pre-Raphaelites in 1850. Its very title suggests the formative role of artists' publications. It was here that artistic ideas were not only recorded and exchanged, but germinated. With the development of new printing technologies, the 20th century saw a proliferation of periodicals and publications for which artists served as publishers, editors, writers, typographers, and designers. These included futurist, Dada and surrealist, and constructivist publications. In 1936, the critic Walter Benjamin speculated that the work of art reproduced is now becoming the work of art designed for reproducibility. Same time, Andre Malraux imagined that the pages of publications might form a museum without walls. If these ideas challenged traditional understandings of art, they equally questioned received notions of publishing. Marcel Duchamp, for example, created a portable museum housed in a contained miniature facsimiles of his works, including versions of his ready-mades that could fit into a dollhouse. Later in the 1960s and 1970s, artists embraced publications as exhibition spaces for conceptual art. The pages of the magazine Fluxus consisted of envelopes containing artist-designed multiples and objects. Publications were ideal for art that was more concerned with process and performance than with final marketable form. Aspen Magazine published conceptual art in the form of a cardboard box that contained unbound multimedia documents, including records, films, and posters. With the growing importance of documentation in conceptual art, the line between curating and publishing became blurry. Lucie Laporte created a series of exhibition catalogs comprised of loose index cards to be rearranged and read at random. traditional sausage recipe, but replaced the meat with a book. SMS was a limited edition portfolio published for 1 year in 1968. Its initials stood for Ship Must Stop. This phrase indicates the anti-establishment ethos that underwrote the use of publications to escape the gallery space during this time. Meanwhile, the influence of mainstream commercial magazines such as Art Forum was growing. As one art historian stated, a reproduction in a magazine is worth two one-person shows. Against the authority of the commercial art magazine and mainstream art criticism, artists asserted their own voices in the pages of magazines like Avalanche, which was founded to support the alternative artistic community in Soho in the 1970s. In the first issue of the feminist art magazine, Heresies, the editors wrote, quote, "We reject the standard relationship of criticism to art within the present system. We will not advertise a new set of genius products just because they were made by women." While such challenges to the art world establishment were serious, they could also be humorous. One issue of the magazine Landslide was an actual McDonald's hamburger mailed out to prominent curators and critics. Correspondents and mail artists used publications to create unofficial, decentralized information structures within the art world. File magazine invited readers to vote for their own favorite artists instead of accepting the critics' expert opinion. File prompted a string of irreverent takeoffs. File was founded in San Francisco in the 1970s. It was devoted to the idea that the process of communication and exchange is important, regardless of the aesthetics and skills of the sender. Bile continued the joke. This photocopied rubber-stamped magazine was published by Bradley Lastname. What's his real name? The egalitarian premise of mail art to its limit. It proposed that all magazines be called Smile and encouraged readers to publish their own issues. Okay. So you don't know how many issues there are. To publish literally means to make public. In the 1960s and 1970s, art publishing was a distinctly political effort to make art more accessible and democratic. Art Right magazine sold art for the price of a gallon of milk with its Dollar Art series. Attesting to how much things have changed, a full set of Art Right was recently appraised at $20,000. And if the meaning of publishing is certainly different today, its potential clearly remains compelling to artists. Issue. I'm afraid that I think we're going to steal that McDonald's idea. So next up is Brian Andrews, who is a visual artist and the West Coast producer for Bad at Sports Contemporary Art Talk, and Duncan McKenzie, who is also a visual artist and the executive producer for Bad at Sports Contemporary Art Talk.
So typically the first question that we get was, it's distributed over the internet, either by RSS feed or through iTunes, or you can sign up a podcatcher or anything technology like. We were founded in 2005 by these two gentlemen, Duncan McKenzie and Richard Holland in Chicago, really sort of out of desire to communicate with a lot of artists when they sort of leave graduate school and expand out in their careers, lose a lot of points of contact, find out really what's going on in each other's studio practice, and that sports is a way to respond to and get that. Now, Bandit Sports specifically is by artists for artists, and the idea here was artists in their studio making the work need to hear and understand and communicate what's going on in the process and want to know what's going on in other people's studios. Actually, it's designed really at first to be a conversation to listen to while you're painting. As artists continue on here, the mode of conversation is meant to be more like the conversation that happens at the bar after an opening. We're not NPR, we're not October Magazine, we're not Gotcha Journalism. We just want to talk about shit and actually be able to say shit and have a good time to actually understand what's going on with our artworks. Since 2005, as you can see, our team has grown with representatives here on the West Coast, in New York, some people in Europe. We're publishing every week, every Sunday, a full hour of audio using this entire team, as well as sort of a more loose network of friends and affiliates. These next few slides here is just an index of all of the episodes that have been produced. We crossed the 5-year milestone this summer. Let's take a few slides to make it through this list. As you can see, there's really an incredible diversity. One of the things that you get, this is over 300 hours of recorded audio and conversation. Spanning the range from dealers, big blue chip artists, emerging artists, curators, people think that we're just kind of moving, think we're just kind of funny. anyone that we think actually can add to the conversation or add to sort of the oral history of the contemporary art world around us. So with that,
yeah, you presented this as being very thoughtful, and I suppose in retrospect it is easy to sort of see a kind of working logic, but I feel like it was started more dumbly than that. It was, we figured out that it's, you could distribute a radio show on the internet and felt like, oh, that means we could say fuck. And that means we could do things that NPR could never do. Because they're worried about their subscriber base and they're worried about cash coming in the door. And the overhead for doing what we did was very low. So we could essentially produce something where we thought, oh, yeah, we'll just talk shit about our friends' work. And it'll upset them, and it'll be kind of funny, and we'll do something that's somewhere between, a thoughtful BBC show and Howard Stern, and it's going to be awesome. That's our blog. We'll get back to that in a second. We can take it up now. Like the blog, like everything that sort of happened in this project, we grew organically. That was actually our first hate mail when I moved out here. So that was a nasty email after episode one to Duncan. By episode nine, I was contributing within that year, I've become a contributor and now founding principal for the project, and the project really grew based off of success because there really wasn't a real interest or something, but because there was no model, no real direction for this, lots of things were tried, and things that worked kept being repeated, and things that didn't work. So after these 5 years, we have much more of this regulated range. It's evolved in this form where people feel like they can come forward and have conversations that they wouldn't necessarily have or be reluctant to have with an art historian or an arts journalist because of maybe the states that were involved or having to have everything sort of packaged in a completely formalized manner.
Yeah, the ethos has always been arts workers talking to other art workers.
Yes.
Sorry, I looked up with a kind of board, like I'm missing
the material. So what has this become? After 2 years, we have over 300 hours of really unique audio documenting the history of contemporary art in Chicago, San Francisco, New York, and a few other places. And the question of this topic is, when publishing is not publishing, we've been meeting publishing deadlines every week and really not actually published anything. But we have this wealth of material that has so many potential avenues from archive, installation, web-based application, even artworks generated themselves that can be based off of this wealth of material that's been contributed to lovingly by the community that lets us get in our face and jump microphone and ask them more questions. They're going to ask them questions we ought not to. Cool. Well, actually, if any of you guys get bored here today with this method, we're actually going to be at Ridgeway doing two live interviews as well as part of Chris Duncan's FMI exhibition. We can actually see us sort of participate in this live.
Yeah, so you should totally leave here and find all of us from the epic and come together and come with a bigger Ridgeway.
So what's the future for the show, Duncan?
That's an interesting question. I think that the show continues to evolve and the blog continues to evolve, and we've always been a very personality-driven and personality-oriented tact where people follow the nose and sort of see what they're interested in, and it should be all about what our contributors are interested in, the conversations they're interested in having. So I think we will go with our friends and do the things we want to do. Keep talking about our
artist based in San Francisco, whose work is accented by appropriation and post-production and the delivery of sensory animations around fragmented forms, portraying clashing ideologies, crumbling symbols, and broken icons. And she's going to be presenting on Stand the Block, Bologna.
My take on this from the perspective of the artist-driven project. Scandal Bologna is inspired by Seminar, a free-form art and poetry journal published sporadically by artist Wallace Berman in California in the 1950s and 60s. Short bursts of avant-garde poetry, prose, photography, collage, and drawing were printed in a hand press and mailed out to a couple of hundred Kindred spirits. With a somewhat irreverent attitude and a DIY ad hoc approach, Berman was able to create his own culture and community. I saw the show Seminar Culture at Berkeley Art Museum in 2006, and that just seemed to resonate. In 2008, after running a project space called TARP for 3 years, I initiated the Skank Not Bologna publication, and it's also sporadic, 4 issues to date, and who knows how long it's going to run. Skank Not Bologna is taken from a song by the UK... Are we not moving on? We are? Sorry. Skank Not Bologna is taken from a song by the UK post-punk band Skrillex. I was a fan back in the day. We sang Marx's songs about Jack Derrida and hegemony. What was it like? The first EP was a limited release of our own label. It was hand-stamped and included a breakdown of the production costs and the photocopied sleeve cover. So here we have a demystification and a deconstruction of the whole record publishing model. So right back to George, who mastered the sound recording. So that's kind of, that's from 1978, actually. And it was pretty heavy as day, heavy as time. So another inspiration is Sing Magazine, Curatorial Crossing, which was started in 1995 and born out of a curatorial collaborative spirit. It was comprised of rotating curated projects, and it often, included free materials such as posters, CDs, tapes, etc. I thought this was great. I think it's one of the early art magazines to actually do this. Here's Skype Block Bologna itself, a loose leaf collection of works from an international group of artists, poets, and writers. It comes in edition of 50 to 100. It's housed in a 10 by 13 envelope. It's very cheap to produce. The artists make copies of the contribution by paper for envelope, label, and postage. So what's coming up next are some examples of contributions to Skype Block Bologna from other artists who also publish in one form or another. On the left, we have Alan Rupert-Burke. He did a great project with Freeze a couple of years ago called Placemats and Poems, where he performed and sold poems at reduced prices during the fair. On the right, we have Coda Jacobson. He has a binder, a trimmer, and a black and white printer. And for the most part, he's trying to do print on desire. Here we have Torka Nichols on the left. He has a project called Anonymous Postcard, and in his words, it's a suggestion box for the world. Claims submitted by the public are intended to vague and largely indecipherable postcards and mailed towards appropriate recipients. Right, Ryan Gander, rising art star. He contributes number 3 and then he also Francisco, I'm working with people like myself, and the thing always next for me is an artist, Ron Press, based in Scotland, edited by Lucy Keeney. The premise is that each issue shifts in racial format. I was actually included in the first issue, which was printed like the newspaper. The third issue was included in Scan Block Rule number 4, and was actually on a CD voice. CD, if that makes sense. I just like this hairy piece by Fabian Lazzara, it's very nice. I see Skank as an extension of my own practice as a lens-based artist. I work with sample fragments of film, still, sound, and text, and exploring the deconstruction of the image. You know, I don't really think of what I do as publishing per se, although I like the idea of subverting that model just a wee bit. The fourth issue turned the framework, the fourth issue from the framework of my recent program residency at Berkeley Art Museum's late series, and became the first time based in paper issue. Invited artists including Tosh Berman, Jennifer Locke, Alan D'Souza, William Wiley, and of course the lovely Tanya, and others contributed performance, spoken word, screening, sound, and conversation, loosely themed around Skank Block Bologna was Berman's critability. Over the course of 5 evenings, remnants from these contributions built into the paper issue. One of the distinctive ideas behind number 4 was a blurring of lines between performance and artifact, in the sense that the hybrid experiences became the basis of the physical publication. Skank Block Bologna was an open-ended process, with the final issue launching at the end of the series. And what I liked about this was the way it unfolded in space over time. Tanya actually did a piece for this, and it was sort of, there you go, URL, sort of behind the scene recording, which you can listen to at your leisure. We had some other great experiences, which included Green's Screen Music Cover Band, a film starring Derek Derman's Pasolini, Tosh Berman presented Aleph, Wallace Berman's one and only film, and I commissioned the Cal Fencing Club to reenact Jack Goldstein's 2 fencers. Larry renewed this to see the wonderful mise en scène you created, which transformed and helped the space, so very proud of that. That's Eugene Robinson. He read from his recent book, and then we tore a page out from the novel and put it there. You know, that's Jennifer Locke's. She did a wrestling thing, and that's a piece of a wrestling suit, so we have that included in the issue. Number 4 is on sale at the Band Bookshop. We'll be going into their library in a moment, I think. Poetic Research Bureau in LA carries some issues. They're an interesting organization. They specialize in poetry theatre. They have a theatre shop in the library. There are a limited number of copies left, so tomorrow we'll launch Skank Block Bologna number 5, which will reflect back on this whole weekend. It will be made up of ephemera from all the participating publications of the fair, so come back tomorrow, please. Yes, I do hope it does have the life seminar does. And you know, I know Tosh Berman now, so I really feel committed to that spirit and still just like wishing. Thank you.
And Will Rogan, who are visual artists as well as the co-editors and publishers of the Fang Quarterly.
All right. We thought we would present this to you in a way where we've rehearsed it so much it's a little more improvisational. So. Part of this section is dealing with the issue of publishing and it's not publishing, and so that's really been a dilemma for us with the thing we call it a publication, and we realize that it's problematic, but we were drawn together by the idea of text and object and publishing. We like those three elements.
We both, Will, by the way, this is time in case. We both also come from a background that deals with text in some way. I was a librarian for 5 years before I met John, and John was teaching English for 5 years as well. And we have gone so far as to call what we do a magazine to several people who have gone out of their way to correct us and say that it's a misnomer to call it a magazine. But publishing is important to us. And as I was listening to the other people talk before us, I was like, well, that's publishing. That's also publishing. You know what I mean? So to speak to it not being publishing is a little bit harder, because I feel like we kind of are always saying publishing into magazine.
That's right, well.
That was the reverse.
That was on cue. So a lot of these images are images of publications in our daily life. And both of us, well, we think of these publications as objects. I mean, the bookshelf has objects that are books and also magazines. There was one earlier that's a publication. And so I guess what we're putting forth is that the publication is an object. Obviously, it's a delivery system for information, but it also, we think, if we turn it around the other way, it can become an object that's a publication. And we're still figuring our way through this, and it's problematic, as I said earlier.
And it's also, I think, at the end of the day, our interest lies in where the text affects the object. You know, and that's the same for an object that has text on it, whether it's like a doorstop or reserve from the library I work in.
You mentioned sweatpants, the way they've changed.
Or sweatpants, we have text on them. Completely different sweatpants. And so, I mean, not to be like too, not that it's like, oh, you really, we are interested in that. We're interested in the shift that happens when texting in our personal work. Before we did this, it was very, a lot of what we did was about that as well, individually.
So, the thing, here's an image of the picture, the water picture that I have. So I guess this is a good example of this thing has a lot of this idea of imbuing the objects with some kind of specialness. And I think we all have these objects around our house that serve a purpose, but they also have this history to them. Here's one of Will's.
This is a roll of tape that someone gave me and then a fly got caught in, but it was being real long with him. It's like a fly caught in amber. But then, and so, yeah, what you said about, like, sort of, like, there's objects around you that, like, end up in the garbage eventually, and that's not what we want to make, you know? Like, and so, text is one way, and working directly with artists is one way of sort of, like, imbuing these objects with something more. And I think that if there's, like, an overarching, like, one of the overarching reasons for that is, like, we want to care about the things that are around us, and we want to also live with them. And being artists who produce work, get stuck in a situation where you can't buy your own work was one of the kind of, like, that was where the rehearsal worked right there. Like, that's the right
choice, of course.
But that was one way to sort of, like, make this work for us. You know, there were selfish reasons for doing this. You know, we want to, I want to live with other artists' work. And I want other people to have the opportunity to as well.
So one of the issues we were having is that we wanted this to be a democratic process, as well saying. And so that's something that doesn't seem to exist where you can, I guess there are edition houses, obviously, and we're interested in doing something that is more like a magazine in that regard, so that it has the publication model, so that anyone can get the subscription as a back issue if it's available, or when it's out, just as you would like New Yorker or Harper's or something like that. But at the same time, we want people to be able to live with this as well and to use them and to read them. So these are examples of the issues and use just kind of randomly. That's Chris Jameson's there, the cops. That's Starlikind's cutting board.
We actually made Starlikind's pretty much from the ground up, which not all of them are like that, but we stood in this wood shop and got covered in sawdust for like 3 days while staring at the eye of a router, trying not to cut our fingers. And that, like, the work of putting this thing out is important to us as well. We hold these wrapping parties that were in people coming together. And Southern Exposure has been kind enough to do that for us twice, I think, at this point, maybe 3 times.
Well, actually, that just started too.
Pretty much. And Southern Exposure.
So, to come back to this main point again, the idea of creating a publication that's not necessarily a publication, but to follow the model, to say that it is a publication, obviously, is problematic. And it's something that we're seeing around outside in the world as well. There are a lot more subscription-based periodicals, object-based periodicals that are showing up. We came in at a time when there were already a bunch as well. So, and we've seen from Bounds that there's a history of this. So this is really exciting and interesting to us.
Is it a watch as an issue?
In use.
And I think that the other thing we wanted to talk about was the way everyone leaves the Bay Area and how sad that is. So, like, stay, if you're publishing here, stay for a while. We understand.
title for this topic is 20 Different Ways to Mispronounce Your Name, but our next speaker is Tanya Katenjian, who is the editor-in-chief of The Unobserved. Which is what I originally am and continue to be. I know how much work goes into making a radio piece. It's amazing how much, and yet it only goes on for just a brief amount of time, and then it's gone. It's a very ephemeral medium. But The Unobserved wants to breathe new life into pieces that have been aired, and actually give them more is a very growing archive of interviews with interesting artists, curators, thinkers from around the world, and we try and get the more unseen aspects of the creative process, the sensitive, the possibly blunt, and certainly humorous moments. So there are many online journalists on The Unobserved from here, from the UK, from Australia, from Ireland, all over the world. But we wanted to get stuff from their cutting room floor, their B-sides, the things that they created that might have inspired them to get into sound in the first place. Certainly things that you might not hear, most likely not on the radio. Sort of invites you to actually
give time, and it promises to give you back what you give to it, because it's with time that you really gain a relationship, and it's between you and the producer that happens. So the Unobserved is a website right now. It really just started, and this is our first public appearance. We're going to be doing apps, of course, and events, national and local, and eventually we'll have something tangible. But this is where you are right now. And I really invite you.
I'm sure.
I just want to make a plug for the library that we have here on the corner that's part of the Art Publishing Now Summit, because a lot of the works that were discussed today in this panel, and I think throughout the day, are available to view there. So please take a look at it today or tomorrow. And it'll also be here at Southern Exposure through December, I believe, and it is still open for submissions. So any of you who have not managed to bring your publications, come be a part of the library. The library is also online for online publications. This is probably going to be too short of a Q&A session. We only have 15 minutes, and what I think is very important to me and a lot of the people in the committee for developing Art Publishing Now is to have an open dialogue with you and the guests. But I'd like to start with a question to get everything started. Thank you for breaking the ice today, everyone. For this event, you have been labeled non-traditional in regard to publishing. But do you see yourself that way? And is non-traditional as a label actually hiding what can be seen as an evolution of publishing, maybe as it pertains to our world? Or is this non-traditional conditional on new media?
I certainly see the Unobserved as non-traditional, and that's sort of the point, is to try and get things that aren't necessarily traditional. But I think the definition of traditional is, I don't think we really know what traditional is anymore, because we're in such a moment of innovation with the changing landscape. we're creating traditions. I mean, I guess we saw even today through the presentation that even 40 years ago, 50 years ago, 60 years ago, it wasn't really traditional. So it's hard to say. It's hard to say what's traditional anyways. But I certainly think we are all untraditional. Would you agree? Yes.
I don't think we should get bogged down with definitions like traditional and traditional. I think I agree with Tanya. I think we're well beyond that now. And what we're doing is experimental. I like the word experimental, actually. I think that's far more kind of experimental.
Experimental as well. I mean, I think that we're also a part of a tradition, but I think as a thing, we sort of like tend to talk about ourselves in an untraditional way because of that same thing that you said, Anne, about not wanting to be pinned down in a way, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I might interject another term into the dialogue, which is historical, but, you know, as well as traditional. I think that there is a history of using publications in untraditional ways as a medium. And I think that that history doesn't mean that what's going on today is just repeating something that happened in the past, or that, you know, I think that there can be a really interesting dialogue between what's going on in the present, what has gone on in the past, and that not only does the past or history of this kind of medium inform what's going on today, but that what's going on today can inform how we understand that history as well. So there's really a contemporary style out there.
I can agree with that. There's a second part to your question, which was this connection to these ideas of new media, which is a term that's thrown around and kind of means nothing now. But our early history, I think, is actually really tied down to the specific timing and moment that podcasting became available. You know, when Duncan Merchant started, it was a really new thing. A lot of people had no idea what it was. And those voices filled the void of that technology. Within 18 months to 2 years, everybody knew what podcast was, but then all the podcasts have already become video. Why are you guys doing video? Why are you doing all these other things? And part of it is like, that just sounds like so much more work, and it's really boring. But the other side of it was, is this thing that only lasted 18 months, literally 18 months old at that point, already had found a form, and therefore we were already sort of fitting into that, and it became not a choice out of necessity, but a willful choice to not hold ourselves to that format. And so, podcasting is a little bit.
Yeah, I don't think of us as experimental. I don't think of us as non-traditional. I think of us as curious makers, like we're people who make things and we're very curious about the world around us. And part of what we do allows us to explore our curiosity and have our questions answered and share those answers with other people.
But I do think that it's hard, you know, that because we're still searching for terminology for what it is that I think a lot of us here are doing. And tradition allows for terminology. And we're sort of creating a new lexicon. I mean, not we are, but, you know, we all are. That's what this, like I said, the digital age is really opening up, is to create a new language. And I think we're figuring out what that language is. We're not only creating it, but we're also looking for our relationship to it and seeing what fits, what doesn't fit, what feels right, what feels off.
Karen, there's a question related to that.
Sounds like
I want someone else to answer that.
It sounds like we are, because a lot of us are highlighting the work of others that we really love, or that we really think is very beautiful or strange, or opposed to so much read. We are trying to distill that, and that's what I think that is this kind of thread through all of us here.
Well, there's also this seems to be a dedication to a format. In the sense that when you're talking about you choose a format, there's this object published, in essence, text in relation to the thing. And you decided to take that podcast as your main output. So if you and you're dedicated to bringing sound to the web in this way. So that itself is a correlation, I think, to all of the pieces that your publications are working under.
To an extent, curating as well. I think Graham made an interesting point about the lines of blurred between curating and publishing, and I think that's certainly true. And you can really think about all of our works as a bit of curatorial process, if you like, because we are actually inviting in other artists, working with other artists. So yeah, I do actually see that link now, actually. Good question, and it's nice to think about.
I was thinking about the in terms of publishing in general, it seems like right now it's going through a transition, right? I mean, there's this the issue with magazines are losing subscriptions and they're going to the web. Newspapers are trying to figure out how they survive. And so I see a lot of looking around right now in general of what the future is. I mean, McSweeney's had the really amazing newspaper that they, what's the name of it? The Beaver. And that was an idea towards this model, and I see, what's going on online in general as alternatives to that. But it does seem like in all this, there's this exploration of object at some point, where people are involved physically in doing something in a space. I guess that's not quite a correlation, but I'm trying to figure out. I'm curious about that because this is happening, and I guess this conference is about that. It's thinking about those things on a larger scale.
Actually, that relates to a follow-up question. But I want to turn it more towards this idea of audience. And I read in Anne Coleman's description of Stamp Block Bologna this phrase, a couple of hundred kindred spirits. And so please speak about your target audience. And at what point does your desire for a certain size audience become a need for a certain size audience in order to survive, let's say, as a self-supported project?
It's funny to think about because I think we, when we started Bennett Sports, we were sort of looking around for something like Bennett Sports. It wasn't, but it just didn't exist. Like we had a lot of time doing manual stuff in our studios. We had a lot of time that we could interface with audio material, and we were really disappointed with the range of stuff that was sort of visually art, visual fine arts focused or culturally focused, and felt like there was a voice that was unrepresented there, so we sort of we made what we wanted to listen to. In the beginning, we were like, wouldn't it be amazing if 100 people listened? And then you're like, oh, well, now 500 people are listening. And then you're like, wouldn't it be amazing if 1,000 people are listening? And then all of a sudden, 5,000 people are listening or more in an episode, and you're like, what the hell are we doing? And then you just, people care, and you're sort of amazed. And then I feel like then we stuck to our format because we had created an expectation with the audience that we had entered into some sort of bargain, and we did it for them, not us. But it's never been a kind of economic drive. Like we don't make any money. Like we cover our overhead costs with like Google ads, but that's about it. So we've never really formalized a mechanism by which we could generate revenue because we didn't want to be beholden to anybody who was paying us, except that audience. But then we also, we're not thoughtful enough to be like, hey, we should do a funding drive. So if we ever, we've done one, then it was in an emergency. So, I don't know. Thanks for listening. Please listen more.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point. The idea of an audience. I think I'm even less than 200 kindred spirits, to tell you the truth. I mean, I certainly don't send out 200 people curators, other artists, collectors. People I want to engage, really. I think that's my audience. But, that's it.
Well, I was recently asked what my target audience is, and I actually realized that I don't want a target audience. I want, and particularly since it's online, we're all out there playing around, touching, and exploring. And someone said that the excerpt was like a Pandora of curiosities, and I loved that because I thought there's so many things that I discover on Pandora that I would never know that I liked. And then I suddenly realized, oh, wait, I do like that kind of music, or I do really like that band. And I want someone to come to the excerpt and say, that's a really beautiful piece from that random person in Munich. And I think that that's really important in that not to actively not have a target audience, but to think of the expandability and the vastness of the audience that's out there.
I have a bunch of different ideas on how to answer this question. So the light comes to me, but one thought was, for John and I, we both, everyone has lots of things to do, but we both have families and our practices and teaching commitments of our own. So in a way, we don't, and this may sound irresponsible, but we have built it in a way that we don't have to consider the audience as much. We want to put things out into the world that we care about, and we want them to be in the world in an affordable way. And we want them to be really good, and then beyond that, it's kind of ran itself so far, and I'm sure everyone in publishing, we also it's not a money-making endeavor. It really is just about putting these things in the world and making sure that we can do it. We've done it at 1,000, 1,200 subscribers. We've done it at much lower, and so far it's worked.
That's right. And I think one of the things is we want it to be super democratic, but we want it to be anyone can get this, and we get really excited about the fact that it might not operate in the art world at all.
That's a good question because I must admit this issue, Scott Bobby, before at Borgiar Museum, is probably what I'm most excited about actually, because it really is what was it? I called it Scott Bobby before. It was a series of hybrid experiences, and then that was evolved into the actual publication. Remnants, each artist left a remnant, it was built into the project. So I think that's a really interesting model because you're playing with many facets of the curatorial, the exhibition, the publication. Ultimately, it's a hybrid model. What was your question again? I've forgotten in terms of the events incorporating themselves into the publication. Right. So basically, what you're left with in my case was that you have this physical memory, if you like, in an envelope, is probably the best way of putting it. And in there, you're getting, a red gel from one of the performances. You're getting a pencil that was part of an installation. You're actually getting a piece of Jennifer Locke's wrestling suit. So, that creates a whole new experience. Personally, I think it relates to what you said about your radio program and the relationship between the listener and the
through, if you like, being me and the artist and the experience